The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post and the Associated Press. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. The collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge on March 26 has no doubt increased anxiety among many travelers. Crossing bridges are an everyday occurrence for many of us, but I can only imagine the tension and anxiety some must feel as they cross the bridges to work, to home, or other destinations. Well, today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to examine some of these issues that have arisen since the Key Bridge collapse. And our first article comes from the March 27, 2024 issue of the Washington Post. Now, it's written by Andrea Sachs and Hannah Sampson, and the headline reads, "Bridges are their nightmare. The Baltimore collapse made it a reality and leads to an increase in anxiety for fearful travelers." So let's learn more as we proceed. On Tuesday, May 26th, while the country was transfixed on the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, psychiatrist Elias Abujud, heard from two of his clients in California who each suffer from acrophobia, the fear of heights. They told the Stanford Medicine clinical professor they were trying to find out whether they had crossed the bridge on previous trips to the East Coast. "It's exacerbating their anxiety because it's proving to them that their fear of bridges and their fear of heights is not unreasonable, that this could have happened to them when they were on this bridge," Abujud said. The horrifying scene of an out-of-control cargo ship taking down a 185-foot-tall bridge has triggered anxiety in people who struggle with several fears, including claustrophobia, amaxophobia, which is driving, and Jeffrobia, which is crossing bridges. It's not a far leap to watch video of the collapse and picture yourself falling into the Patapsco River. For some, it feels like a bad dream come true. Retired sales executive Dave Scarangella, 67, wrote on X on Tuesday that the Key Bridge collapse was his recurring nightmare in real life. "He gets panic attacks on high bridges," he wrote, and more than a dozen people replied to share their own fears. "I don't know if it's an innate fear of control, that the car will somehow take a right turn and dive into the water or something," Scarangella said in an interview Wednesday, noting that the fear really grips him at the top. "It doesn't make any sense." And again, just to date this was around May 26, May 27th that these interviews took place. Taking lengths to avoid bridges. Bridges are part of daily life for many. They factor into our holidays and vacations. People like Scarangella of Ashburn, Virginia, may plot an elaborate course to circumvent an anxiety-inducing crossing. Abujud said, "One patient's commute is 3 hours instead of 30 minutes it would take to use a bridge." Scarangella said he has delegated bridge driving to colleagues and family members for years. He has avoided the Francis Scott Key Bridge and the Bay Bridge in Maryland. Family getaways are carefully planned. By the way, the Bay Bridge, I've done that many times. It's 4 miles, and I can understand some of their concerns. Yes, it's 4 miles before you hit land again as you cross it. We continue with the article. "Whenever we choose a vacation that won't have a high bridge," he said, "and if we were to come across one by accident, we would just look at a map and drive around it." This according to Mr. Scarangella. Now, at several bridges around the country, nervous drivers can hand their car keys over to a professional driver. The escort programs, as they're called, are run by a mix of bridge operators and private transportation companies. The Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel in Virginia has been assisting nervous drivers since at least the 1990s. In 2006, the authorities formalized the free program, which is available year-round. "We just get as many calls in the middle of the night as we do in the middle of the day," said Corporal Spencer Parks. "Travelers in passenger cars should book in advance, preferably 24 hours before their arrival time. They will meet an emergency crew worker at either end of the bridge, pay the toll, which is $16 or $21, depending on the season. If a crew member is not available, their other responsibilities include driving wreckers and assisting in the toll booth. A police officer might take the wheel. Edward Spencer, the director of operations and chief of police for the Chesapeake Bay Bridge and Tunnel District, said 500 to 600 people request an escort each year. Spencer, who was answering the phone Tuesday night, said he highly doubts the Key Bridge collapse will cause an uptick in calls. Drivers can get a hand crossing the Chesapeake Bay Bridge in Maryland from the Kent Island Express, which promises to let you relax and enjoy the ride and the view. The service, which is not affiliated with the Maryland Transportation Authority, cost $40 in cash and $50 by credit card during regular business hours, according to the website. Now, drivers need to give at least an hour advance notice. Patty McAllen, 60, used the Kent Island Express a couple of years ago when she needed to attend a work meeting on the Eastern Shore. She said it was worth the cost. While short bridges made of concrete don't bother her much, she has issues driving on bridges with grates where the water is visible and long bridges. It was a windy day when she used the service, and I thought to myself, God, I'm so glad you did this, she said, because I've driven over that bridge before, and it's just a white-knuckle experience for me. McAllen's now retired from fundraising for nonprofits, called the company and scheduled a meeting time, then followed up when she was nearby. A young woman got into the Chevrolet Spark at a spot near the bridge. Another employee followed them over, and the driver pulled over near a business on the other side where McAllen took over again. Very efficient, said McAllen, who lives in Alexandria, Virginia, at the time and now lives in New York State. She remembers complimenting the driver on how well she was doing, even if she wasn't technically watching what was going on. I probably closed my eyes, she said. The 440-foot-high Delaware Memorial Bridge, which spans the Delaware River, offers a similar program. Travelers who should call 10 to 15 minutes ahead of time will receive to a safe pull-off where they can wait for an officer. Dispatcher Deanna Glasgow said they typically receive a bump in calls over the holidays and on days with extreme weather, excessively rainy or windy or spectacularly sunny. Summer is a huge peak time for us, she said. The service is free, but the car owner must pay the $5 toll. The roughly 5-mile-long Mackinac Bridge, which connects Michigan's upper and lower peninsulas, has offered an assistance program to nervous drivers since the 1980s. Partly to blame for those nerves, high winds, which can prompt advisories and closures and cause the bridge to move. At all hours, any day of the week, drivers can make a request for a bridge staffer to drive their car across the mighty Mack. The service was suspended in the early days of the pandemic, but it returned in late 2021. By then, officials had reviewed the cost of the formerly free program and decided users needed to pay. The cost now, $10 plus toll per tip, increasing to $15 in 2025. The average cost to provide the service is about $33 per trip, according to the Mackinac Bridge Authority. Overcoming fears through exposure. The fear of bridges can be a singular phobia or a tangle of anxieties, such as driving, heights, loss of control, tight spaces, or mistrust of infrastructure. The type of bridge could also trigger a panic attack. For some people, it's now how high the bridges are. For other people, it's the structure of the bridge or the length or whether it's over water, said Martin Antony, a psychology professor at Toronto Metropolitan University. Of course, there are people who are afraid of all bridges, he said. Robert DuPont, a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University, said he did not encounter patients who feared a bridge collapse. They were afraid of their own behavior while crossing over a bridge, like jumping off of it. It's a common phobia, he said, adding that it's one of the phobias that people keep a secret. Now, driving across a bridge becomes something they won't do. This collapse, referring to the Key Bridge, may prompt some people to confront it again. Antony, who wrote a book about overcoming fears, said the most effective and evidence-based therapy involves exposure. Now, he takes his clients to bridges where the patient or a friend of the individual will repeatedly drive across the structure. The idea is to exorcise the fear by normalizing the experience. We will go back and forth long enough for the people to learn that whatever they are predicting isn't going to happen, he said. Their fear comes down over time, usually. Now, the only treatment is to do it, DuPont said. You've got to get on the bridge and do it often. The peace lies on the other side of fear. For the cognitive segment of therapy, Abu Jaloud uses rationalization techniques, such as pointing out how his client's worst fears rarely materialize. For the behavioral portion of treatment, he will safely and gradually expose them to their fears through virtual reality and other technologies. He said bridge escort programs are a band-aid, but not a long-term solution. The traveler won't always have the service or the time or logistics to circumvent bridges. To expel their fears, they need to face them head on. A small minority of patients with acrophobia actually seek treatment, he said. Most of them deal with it through avoidance. Scarangella, the retired executive in Virginia, said he has watched the videos of drives over bridges in the interest of trying to cure myself and found his heart rate elevated after watching. He's skeptical more treatment would help. The only thing therapists could really do for me is to drive over the bridge, he said. By the way, Marlene Simons also contributed to this report. Again, it was written by Andrea Sachs and Hannah Simpson for The Washington Post. Well, next, writers Joyce Soshun Lee and Ian Duncan, John Swain, and Stephen Rich are going to look at another issue arising from the Baltimore Bridge collapse. Now, their story appeared in the April 16, 2024 issue of The Washington Post, headlined, "We're a dead ship. Hundreds of cargo ships lost propulsion in U.S. waters in recent years." Less than 2 weeks after Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge was destroyed by an out-of-control cargo ship, another huge container ship passed beneath a busy bridge connecting New York and New Jersey and then suddenly decelerated in a narrow artery of one of the nation's largest ports. "We're a dead ship," said a voice over the maritime radio a short time later, invoking an industry term that often refers to a ship that's unable to move on its own. Three tugboats helped the Shepherd, the APL Qingdao, a vessel more than 1,100 feet long and flying under the flag of Malta, from where it lost propulsion near the Bayonne Bridge to a safe location, authorities said. The ship dropped anchor just upstream from the even busier Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which carries about 200,000 vehicles per day. The April 5th incident is one of hundreds in which massive cargo ships lost propulsion, many near bridges and ports, according to a Washington Post analysis of Coast Guard records. The findings indicate that the kind of failure that preceded the March 26 Baltimore Bridge collapse, the 984-foot dolly, is believed to have lost the ability to propel itself forward as it suffered a more widespread power outage, was far from one of the one-off among the increasingly large cargo ships that routinely sail close to critical infrastructure. Around Baltimore alone, ships lost propulsion nearly two dozen times in 3 years before the tragedy last month. The Post Review found, including a 2021 November incident in which a 981-foot container ship lost propulsion for 15 minutes soon after it passed under the Key Bridge. In 2020, a ship the same size as the Dolly lost propulsion in the vicinity of the Bay Bridge near Annapolis, records show. Adding to the danger, experts say, is a lack of consistent rules on when cargo ships should be escorted by tugboats that can keep them on course even if the engines turn off. While tugboats escorted the Qingdao, as was called for under local guidelines in the New York area, those attending to the Dolly departed from before it struck the bridge in Baltimore, where such decisions are left to ship captains and local pilots, the specially trained sailors who guide ships in and out of ports. Container ships like the Dolly and the Qingdao have doubled in size over the past two decades, experts said, while some American ports, built up over centuries around busy and cramped waterways, have struggled to adapt. "I don't think we've understood fully the consequences of these ships, of these large ships operating in these ports," said Aaron Davenport, a retired senior Coast Guard officer and expert in maritime safety. The Post analysis found that 424 cargo ships longer than 600 feet reported losing propulsion, meaning the engines were shut down, in U.S. waters over the past 3 years. About a quarter of the incidents occurred near a port, bridge, or other infrastructure, the analysis found. The records on propulsion loss were up to date through March 17th, before the incidents involving the Dolly and the Qingdao. After reports of the Qingdao incident, surfaced on social media, the Coast Guard said the ship suffered a loss of propulsion. In some cases reviewed by the Post, the engine suddenly cut out, and others' crews were compelled to shut them down to deal with operating problems. The owner and operator, the APL Qingdao, said that its engines were shut down in a controlled manner after an engine alarm was triggered, and that the ship did not lose electrical power. In Baltimore, a pilots' association has said that the Dolly lost engine and electrical power before it hit the Key Bridge on March 26. And National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Hamady said investigators believe problems with the electrical system were connected to the loss of control of the ship. The FBI has opened a criminal probe that will look at least in part to whether the crew left the port knowing the vessel had serious systems problems, the Post reported. Now, the Coast Guard reports identified several instances of ships striking objects after losing propulsion, including one case in a grain dock in the lower Mississippi River. Other vessels were reported to have run aground near infrastructure after losing propulsion. Coast Guard investigators found that many causes for propulsion loss, the records show. In some instances, a total loss of electrical power led to an engine shutdown. In others, the electrical system stayed online, but propulsion was lost because of mechanical and equipment failures. Valves malfunctioned, seals failed, and filters were clogged. In some cases, poor maintenance or deterioration were blamed for faulty equipment. In others, human error was blamed, including one case in which a ship got underway while an engineer was still doing work on the fuel system. In dozens of instances, investigators reported that tugboats had assisted ships to safety after they lost propulsion. Ships are a particular risk of losing propulsion when crews are maneuvering in confined waters such as ports, which can place additional demands on power systems, according to a 2017 report by the London P&I Club, a leading maritime insurance firm. Crews changing the type of fuel being used while the ship is underway to comply with regional environmental regulations has also increased the number of propulsion loss incidents, the report said. Joseph Alstrom, a professor at the State University of New York's Maritime College, said in an interview that the frequency of propulsion loss points to a risk that must be better managed. Alstrom said he hopes the use of tugboats, which routinely help ships dock and undock, but can also guide vessels that have lost propulsion to safety, would become more widespread after the Baltimore disaster. Most regulations are written in blood, Alstrom said. It takes something like this for people to say, whoa, we should do something. Our ports are vulnerable. Ships traveling in U.S. waters are required by federal laws to report any loss of propulsion to the nearest Coast Guard command. The Post reviewed hundreds of such reports filed to authorities along the coast, focusing on those involving ships greater than 600 feet. While some of the 424 incidents occurred farther from shore in rivers and bays, in 103 instances, the ship suffered a loss of propulsion near a port, bridge, or other infrastructure, according to the Coast Guard records. Captain John Conrad, founder of the Shipping News website, G Captain, said the Post findings were cause for concern. Our ports are vulnerable, said Conrad, who was first to report on the Qingdao incident in New York. America has to decide, do we want to invest in vessel traffic service, stronger bridges, better maritime Coast Guard investigators, or do we want to roll the dice? In the case of the Agios Dimitrios, the ship that lost propulsion in 2021 after passing the Key Bridge as it sailed toward port in Baltimore, investigators concluded that an electrical fault made the engine non-responsive. Two tugs had been with the ship at the time, and a third joined to assist it back under the bridge to an anchorage near Annapolis for repairs. Global Ship Lease, owner of the Agios Dimitrios, said in a statement to the Post that the crew followed established operating protocols. In close coordination with local tug operators and the Coast Guard, the vessel was able to undergo prompt repairs and proceed without further incident, the company said. In March 2022, an engine problem and strong winds combined to push a 1,200-foot container ship out of a shipping channel near Norfolk, Coast Guard records show. The chief engineer of the Toledo Triumph requested that the ship's engines be shut down after engine room fire alarms went off. At first, according to the investigation report, the ship remained under control, but water leaking from an engine cooling system turned to steam and tripped a separate alarm, preventing the crew from restarting the engine. As the huge ship lost speed, it began to drift, and, pushed by winds of almost 40 miles per hour, it eventually ran aground. The ship suffered no significant damage and freed itself as the tide rose. Showai Kisen Kasha, the Japanese company that manages the Toledo Triumph, declined to comment. No uniform standards for tugboats. There is no single standard for the use of tugs to escort large ships in and out of ports in the United States, experts said. Instead, their use is determined by a patchwork of federal and state laws, formal guidelines, long-standing practices, the judgments of individual pilots, and the financial incentives of ship owners. As container ships have become larger, maritime officials in New York and New Jersey have developed standards for managing the arrival into the port, operated jointly by the states, issuing guidelines on tides, visibility, and the use of tugs. For vessels 997 feet and longer, the guidelines say two tugs should be on hand at the Narrows, the stretch of water between the Staten Island and Brooklyn. As many as five tugs can be required for the largest vessels passing through the Kiel von Kiel, the tidal strait between Staten Island and Bayonne, New Jersey. Federal laws passed since the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill require tug escorts for oil tankers heading into Prince William Sound in Alaska and Puget Sound in Washington State, with a similar state law governing ports in California. The Maryland Port Administration, which oversees the Baltimore Port and the Virginia Port Authority, both said the use of tugs is a decision left to captains and to pilots. Joseph Harris, a spokesman for the Virginia agency, said the weather, the size of a vessel, and the volume of traffic are all factors pilots take into account in making their decisions. Jennifer Carpenter, the chief executive of American Waterways Operators, a trade group for tug companies, said that given the diversity of ports in the country, different practices make sense. It is important to take a port-specific look at what we're trying to do here. What kind of traffic do we have here? How fast are they going? How well are our bridges protected, Carpenter said. Those are all things that should go into an analysis. Tug escort services cost thousands of dollars an hour, according to rate sheets published by major operators. Experts say some that ship owners are reluctant to use them as they look to keep costs down, and that some port authorities oppose tugboat mandates for fear that charging extra fees will make them lose business to competitors. The ship owner and his money are very hard to part, and unless you require it, they're not going to do it, said Walter Nondoli, a professor emeritus at SUNY Maritime College. They're not crazy about spending the money. A dead ship in the Kiel von Kiel Strait. The Qingdao arrived in New York on April 2nd, and during a three-day stop unloaded about 40,000 tons of imports, largely from India and Pakistan, ranging from steel pipes to jasmine rice, according to cargo records. At 7:29 p.m. on April 5th, it set off from Staten Island's Howland Hook Marine Terminal, bound for Norfolk. The ship was escorted by three tugboats. Qingdao passed under the Bayonne Bridge connecting New Jersey and Staten Island at 8 p.m., according to the records for the shipping data service Kepler. About 9 minutes later, as it moved eastward through the tight Kiel von Kiel Strait, the ship slowed, eventually to one-half knot, or about six-tenths of a mile per hour. At 8:17 p.m., tugboats began an operation to assist the Qingdao, Kepler records show. At 8:20 p.m., a voice on maritime radio channel covering the area said that Qingdao was experiencing difficulties. He has lost propulsion, the unidentified voice said. Looks like there might be a dead ship there. The Post found recordings of the remarks by reviewing marine radio traffic archived by Broadcastify. Federal regulations define a dead ship as one that has lost electrical power and one for which backup systems for bringing the main propulsion into operation are not available. Other authorities and maritime groups use the term for a vessel that has lost propulsion and steering. At 8:24 p.m., a different voice came over the radio to say the Qingdao has lost engine power temporarily, has lost engine power but has regained it back. This person said the ship was headed for the Stapleton anchorage site near the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, which links Staten Island and Brooklyn. About 35 minutes later, a third voice on the radio said, "Dead ship, just give me a little bit of time here," as an alarm seemed to blare in the background, and then a moment later says, "So, we're a dead ship." The U.S. Coast Guard said in a statement that the Qingdao reported at about 8:30 p.m. that it had lost propulsion in the Kiel Vankol. The vessel regained propulsion and was assisted to safely anchor in Stapleton Anchorage by three towing vessels, the statement said. Jennifer Patrisco, a spokesperson for CMA CGM, the French shipping giant that owns the Qingdao, said in emails to the Post that the incident began when the ship's main engine alarm sounded soon after it departed New York, restricting full maneuvering. She did not respond when asked why the alarm activated. The loss of propulsion was a controlled, agreed-upon shutdown of the main engine with approval of the pilot and vessel command to temporarily fix an alarm, Patrisco said. She added that after inspections and tests, the ship was declared seaworthy and was cleared by the Coast Guard to travel to Virginia. Records show that it departed Stapleton around 6 a.m. on April 6th. Records show the Qingdao also experienced an engine problem that led to a loss of maneuverability as it left Savannah, Georgia on July 30th. The Coast Guard found that the crew had replaced fuel injectors with parts not recommended by the engine's manufacturer and had failed to keep fuel at a proper temperature, according to a summary of the investigation. Patrisco did not respond to questions about that incident. By the way, Samuel Jornados also contributed to this report again in the Washington Post. Well, we're going to conclude today's episode with an excerpt from an article, "How to Escape If Your Car Goes Underwater," written by Andrea Sachs and Gabe Hyatt and published in the March 26, 2024 issue of the Washington Post, just hours after the Key Bridge collapse. It's a nightmare scenario for drivers. Your car leaves the road and plunges in the water, transforming your vehicle into a sinking trap. The collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in the Patapsco River early Tuesday, May 26, may have stoked fears that you could encounter a similar catastrophe in your own car. Officials with the Baltimore Fire Department said sonar had detected vehicles submerged in the water, but it was unclear whether anyone was inside. A distress call from the freighter that crashed into the bridge and caused the collapse gave officials a time to halt more vehicle traffic over the bridge, said Maryland Governor Wes Moore. As of midday Tuesday, two workers had been rescued from a crew that was repairing potholes on the Key Bridge. Six workers were still missing, and that number, of course, was reduced by the time we recorded this program. In the right conditions, drivers who stay calm have a chance to escape an underwater car. In 2013, a 22-year-old woman from Calvert County, Maryland, survived after her car went off the side of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge and fell 27 feet into the water. 1 minute to get out. Thermal physiologist Gordon Giesbrecht, a retired University of Manitoba professor with an expertise in vehicle submersion with hypothermia, said passengers have 1 minute to rescue themselves from a sinking car. Once the vehicles become partially submerged, the odds of survival are slim. "A minute is kind of an average number," Giesbrecht said, "so windows will certainly work for 60 seconds if you know what you're doing. You can open the window in 10 to 15 seconds. He says travelers should always memorize the acronym SWOC. Seatbelts off, windows open, out immediately, children first. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please direct them to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.